system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We run the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we bring you more news that didn't make the news. We'll look at civil rights issues concerning race and gender, as well as surveillance and privacy issues. We began in conversation with journalist Kevin Gostola of Fire Dog Lake. He's been in Ferguson, Missouri, reporting in the aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown. Sansara Taylor of Stop Patriarchy joins us from Texas for the Abortion Freedom Ride. And we finish the show in discussion with Dr. Nafees Ahmed. We'll talk about his latest series, Exposed. Pentagon funds new data mining tools to track and kill activists at Occupy.com. We hope you stay tuned.
Political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another kind of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. That's the music of Junkyard Empire we want. Today, we want to catch up with several of our guests about civil rights issues concerning race and gender. We'll be looking at surveillance and privacy issues as well. We begin the program today by looking at Ferguson, Missouri, in the aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown. We are joined by independent journalist Kevin Gostola of Fire Dog Lake. Kevin has done amazing reporting over the last several years, particularly on Chelsea Manning and civil rights issues. He has been in Ferguson, Missouri since the shooting there of Michael Brown. And Kevin Gostola joins us by phone to give us some updates on what's been going on there on the ground that the corporate media won't report. Kevin Gostola, you join us by phone.
Yes, hello.
Kevin, thanks so much for coming back on the Project Censored Show. Tell us what's been going on. There's a lot of things that you've been writing about at Fire Dog Lake, and we'd like you to share some of these things with listeners and, of course, tell folks about how they can learn more and read more of your reports.
First off, just so there isn't any confusion, I'm no longer in Ferguson,
right,
Missouri, and I was there up through last Saturday. So I did not get to see how the community grieved collectively and attended the funeral. I think thousands of people tried to attend Michael Brown's funeral. But what I happened to see was sort of the end, the tapering off of the police occupation in Ferguson. And this is actually maybe one of the more underreported and more subtle aspects of what was happening in Ferguson. We've had a lot of, critical corporate media coverage of some of the tear gas that was being volleyed at protesters. We've had some reports of rubber bullets being shot and some reports of stun grenades or smoke bombs being fired at people. But what we really haven't had any criticism of is just the general occupation of this community. The fact that what I saw when I first arrived was that they had taken over an entire shopping area, militarized this shopping center, strip mall, and had the National Guard patrolling like a Target, which is sort of a surreal sort of scene.
Yeah, Kevin, I just had to notice, I saw one of your tweets about that said when you were coming in and out of there that the National Guard said something like, "Hey, how's it going?" And you remarked as if that was normal or something.
It was very friendly. Like, you know, there's no big deal. We're just sitting here with our Humvee parked at the entrance to a shopping center. And, you know, this is something that we might be doing on any given day. And actually, at that point, we had gotten the word that Missouri Governor Jay Nixon had ordered the beginning of the withdrawal from the shopping center from Ferguson of the National Guard, and used the word systematic drawdown. And it was very much like the way they used that word for Iraq, because it took them multiple days to actually remove the National Guard. So I guess the other aspect of the police occupation that has really been given not a lot of attention is the fact that they set up these checkpoints in the neighborhoods of this community. So you had police, particularly the evening hours between around 6 or 7 p.m. through sometime early in the morning the next day, you had officers that would park their cars around the area where most of the demonstrations had been happening. So there was a main road, West Florissant, that ran past the Quick Trip that most people now know is the Quick Trip convenience store that burned down. And then there's the bunch of businesses up and down this main street. And then off on another road called Canfield, if you follow Canfield back, you get to the apartment complex, which is where Michael Brown was gunned down by the police officer, Darren Wilson. And so this area, if you go into the neighborhood, I found, particularly on Friday night when I was following a march that took off to the police station, that you had officers that were parked in these residential neighborhoods that were checking IDs as people were going in and out. And it's very much something that is warrantless, suspicionless, and I think was a systematic violation of the civil liberties of people in Ferguson.
Kevin, hi, this is Peter Phillips. Thanks for being on our show. I'm looking at a piece you wrote called "Ferguson's Municipal Court System Makes Millions Off Targeting Black and Poor People." And you're saying that it's twice as likely that a black person there will be stopped versus a white person, and it's 67% black. So about a third of the community is white. Also that in court systems, of course, large amounts of money are made targeting low-income and black people. So I want to ask you, is this any different than anywhere else in the country? I mean, is Ferguson some really bad racist place? Or do you kind of see these sort of structures everywhere?
My sense is that depending on where you go, you are probably going to find some level of this kind of, I guess, oppression, where you have the exploitation of communities of color, mostly poor working class people in those communities. But I think what's really stark about Ferguson is how blatant or brazen the sort of racism seems to be. And maybe it's not overt racism. It doesn't strike you as people walking around being, you know, clearly racist, although there are some cops that have used the N-word and were calling people in the community animals, talking about how they were happy to be arresting animals. But I think that for the most part, what really sticks out is just how you have about a quarter of the revenue of this suburb of St. Louis dependent on revenue from the traffic violations. And so you have this system built around stopping and even incarcerating these black people in the community. And it doesn't really matter who I spoke to. Any person who described life in North County of St. Louis had some very visceral reactions to the way they are treated on a regular basis by authorities and how they are disposable individuals to their government.
I wanted to ask also about some of the demands that the community there have been making. One, of course, was the arrest of Darren Wilson, the officer who shot Michael Brown. Also, the firing of the chief of police and allow special prosecutors to come in and be appointed so that the county prosecutor should step down. Has any of that materialized, or what's happening in terms of the investigation into the shooting, and what's Darren Wilson's status?
Darren Wilson is AWOL, and I don't think the community has any idea where he's at. The Ferguson Police Department continue to protect him. And as of now, the county prosecutor, Bob McCullough, has a grand jury convened that's hearing evidence, and it's going to probably be months before we get any news about whether Darren Wilson's going to be indicted. And this has been quite the source of anger in the community, because rightfully so, they believe that his skin color has a lot to do with the fact that he has gotten away with not being arrested and charged immediately with committing any sort of a crime. If you talk to people in the community, they'll say it's like he's gotten a paid vacation and he's going to wait a few months to hear if he's going to be charged or not. And there's not a good track record nationally when it comes to holding police officers, especially white police officers, accountable for the killing of people of color. And you only have like a handful of people who have been prosecuted. And in fact, Messerly, one of the only persons in the past decade to actually be somewhat held accountable, though that didn't satisfy the community, somewhat held accountable for being involved in it.
And it took over a year to even process that. And we're looking at some 700 police killings a year annually, all of which are generally rule justified. And on notorious cases like what's happening in Ferguson, it's probably likely, it would be very much like what happened in Sonoma County with the Andy Lopez killing a year ago this October. It took the district attorney 9 months to say that the sheriff is now going to be reinstated and there will be no charges. So, in fact, the sheriff is back on the street, and that's created some difficulties as well. So this is not a rare event. It looks like probably what you're saying there in Ferguson is going to be a long time before we see any resolution or at least any formal statements from the authorities.
And this is why you have them wanting the Justice Department to come in and take over the case, which they have not done up to this point, but this demand for the Justice Department to be investigating the Ferguson Police Department, which actually the Civil Rights Division has done a number of actually decent, in my view, decent investigations, though they don't end in any officers being prosecuted. They've put together some decent reporting on the corruption in some police departments around the country, and I think that's what some of the people in the community want, is attention to some of the systematic crimes in their community. And this is what they've chosen to advocate for because they know that they're not going to get any justice from their local police department, and possibly, though it's also questionable, they would like to see the case taken over by the federal government as a civil rights case, and that would change the dynamic considerably, but they believe that would have a better outcome than letting the county handle it.
We're speaking with journalist Kevin Gostola, who was reporting from Ferguson over a week ago in Missouri. You can find Kevin's work at firedoglake.com. Kevin Gostola, were you there when the second shooting took place in St. Louis with Kajeme Powell, the 25-year-old that was at the receiving end of 12 shots from police?
That was actually the day I arrived in Ferguson. And I was prepared for more outrage from the community, that we would see re-energization of the protests on the ground. But I think that happened in a far enough away part of St. Louis that it didn't really touch the people in Ferguson or inspire them. And they had many of them had already been out demonstrating against police violence for the last week. So it didn't really change things too much on the ground. People I talked to were speaking about what had happened to Kajeme Powell and how, he's basically he's executed like right there. And a big concern from people was actually that they didn't pull out the taser
on camera. I mean, it's on camera. I mean, it was riveting that it was the whole thing was caught on camera.
Yeah, but what might surprise some people who think that across the board you have this opposition to police using force at all. Well, across the multiple people I spoke to actually mentioned, why was it a shoot first thing? Why didn't they go for a taser? Why didn't they If he has a knife and he's trying to stab somebody.
That hadn't been proven, and the video doesn't show that.
Right, that's true, that's true. They played up this whole thing of him having a really sharp sort of knife, and if it's anything, it's a butter knife. He's wearing a jacket, and there's easily ways that they could have taken him down without having to kill him. And then what you saw happen, and this is common in those communities, is you'll have, and this is also what happened in Ferguson, which really upset the community. You have then the officers come in and they take over this area. And if you watch that video, you see towards the end, the officers just very crudely shoving people out onto the edges, threatening to arrest anybody who gets in the way, who tries to see what the police are going to do to the crime scene as they violate it. They put him in handcuffs. They didn't even leave his body lying there for someone to come inspect and actually document what had happened. They put him in cuffs and try to take him back to a hospital or something. And
after he was dead.
Yeah, right. And so this is what you have in communities, and it really makes people angry. Like recently in Chicago, there was a 19-year-old African-American man who was killed on the porch. The residents claim that this person, Rashad McIntosh, was executed with his hands up in the air. It sounds very similar to Michael Brown, that he put his hands up in the air. The officers, in their mind, probably could have made an arrest if they wanted to, but ended up shooting him right there on the porch. And then what happens to the community when they become outraged is they just get pushed far away from that residential area, and they're blocked off, and they don't get any answers, and they're threatened with arrest or even possible use of force against them if they are in the way.
I want to kind of try to make a point here, Kevin, in that if you look back at Rodney King, we look back at Oscar Grant, to varying degrees, there was civil revolt in large that happened in both those cases. And there we see, of course, federal intervention, prosecutions. And for a bit there, it was like Eric Holder was going to get involved, get the Justice Department involved in Ferguson. But as the repression occurred and the revolt was kind of put down, they're back to standard operating procedure. That is, take 6 to 9 months to decide whether you're going to do anything to the officer. So in some sense, a revolt or an outright revolt really does bring a response from the federal government. Would you think that's correct?
This is something that nobody can argue against. Everybody in that community will tell you that there would not have been media in Ferguson if people hadn't started to damage property and burn down the Quick Trip and also, engage in some isolated instances of looting in some of the businesses up along this main road where a lot of the demonstrations were happening. It's just a reality that the rioting brought people's attention to Ferguson, and then at that point, most of the media made the decision that they were going to get there. And then in the couple days afterwards, you had intense tear gassing, you had that militarized show of force that was going on with police, and that added to the interest with media wanting to get out there. But nobody in that community believes that they would have had the space to captivate all of us and get our attention and have people there who were actually interested in what they wanted us to hear if some of those acts hadn't taken place, which is not to say that anybody in that community endorses property damage as a viable tactic of growing a movement, but just to say that there's something really backward and perverse about our society where rioting and committing acts of violence is what it takes for us to actually care about what a movement of people are trying to do.
Well, Kevin Gostolo, we really appreciate you taking time to tell us about your experiences there. We certainly couldn't agree with you more. And we're also grateful that you went there to cover these issues. Certainly J.R. Valerie has been there covering issues. Davey D. here at Pacifica has been covering these issues. So we're lucky that we have some great source resources to find out what's going on and tell other people about what's going on in these communities. So Kevin Gostolo, Fire Dog Lake, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
After this musical break, we'll be right back with Sansara Taylor and Dennis Traynor to talk about the abortion freedom ride. Stay with us. Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue our theme today at civil rights issues concerning race and gender. We now look at Stop Patriarchy. We're joined by Sansara Taylor, who joins us from Texas for the Abortion Freedom Ride. We are also joined by Dennis Traynor of Acronym TV to talk about censorship of these events. And Sansara Taylor, let's begin with you. You were recently arrested for your actions in Texas, but please tell listeners why you're there and what you're doing and a little more about Stop Patriarchy.
Hi, Mickey. Thanks for having me on. I'm down in Texas with StopPatriarchy.org and the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. We've been down here for about a month, traveling across the state, rallying people to stand up for women's right to abortion. And the main reason is because we are currently in a countdown to the greatest round of abortion clinic closures to hit a single state since Roe v. Wade legalized abortion over 40 years ago. Texas had 46 abortion clinics in 2011. And on September 1st of this year, they are scheduled to close down all but six or seven of the clinics. This is going to be devastating for women across Texas, but it's also a major precedent being set in a national war against women's right to abortion. So that's why we're down here. And we went into the streets on Wednesday, a number of us, in front of the UT campus on the first day of classes to challenge young people and students. This is their future. One in three women will get an abortion, and these rights are being stripped from them right now. This is a watershed moment, what's being bolted into place, and it's time for people to step out of their comfort zone, out of their routine, and put something on the line. We've seen that we cannot rely on the courts, and we cannot rely on the politicians to protect women's most fundamental rights to decide for themselves whether to have children. And so a number of us were in the street. A lot of students, actually hundreds of students, gathered and watched. Some of them came into the streets with us. At a certain point, the police singled some of us out and arrested us. We spent the night in jail. It's not the greatest place to be, but we were happy and very proud to be standing up for women at this critical juncture, and many more need to join us in doing the same.
Sansara Taylor, hi. This is Peter Phillips. You were arrested last weekend, on the 27th. And you were actually standing in the middle of the street in downtown Austin, Guadalupe Street. I've seen pictures of that, but, you know, and this was from your website and others, but I've heard no coverage of this in corporate media whatsoever. So how are you getting the word out? And that, of course, will lead into Dennis's part of this. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Peter, is that there has been some actually some significant coverage in some of the local news and some of the national news in Texas, the Austin Statesman, the main newspaper here, did a very, very powerful video of what we did on Wednesday. A number of places have covered it. Univision has covered it extensively, the whole month of activities. What's been most striking is that there's been a resounding silence almost across the board among so-called progressive and left media. A lot of it, I think, stems from the fact that the main sort of Democratic Party platform has been to be silent and let these closures happen. And a lot of the quote-unquote left movements, including pro-choice movements, that are very tied in with the electoral strategy and frankly, down here in Texas, Wendy Davis's campaign for governor. You know, Wendy Davis has made a big effort to avoid talking about abortion. Most people in Texas don't even know these clinics are closing. That's what we've found as we've gone out across the state. And so while there's been some coverage, and there should be more in the mainstream or corporate media, as you call it, what to me has been the most shocking and unacceptable is how much even many of the outlets, the progressive and left outlets or more progressive outlets that have covered Stop Patriarchy and last summer's Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, this summer almost universally have suppressed this story. There's no news of the civil disobedience and the arrests that have happened 2 weeks ago and five of them just a couple of days ago. There's no coverage of the fact that this law is going into effect and the fact that there's a major effort that involves prominent, nationally significant abortion providers across this country and people throughout Texas standing up and resisting this. It's been ignored, I have to say, as well as ignored. It's been suppressed.
Well, let's get to the suppression. Dennis Traynor, Acronym TV, Sansara and I spoke earlier in the week, and she told me a story of your coverage of her and Stop Patriarchy and so on. Tell us a little about your experience with the interview that you did.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. We had Sansara on to talk about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride when the ride began. And we produce and distribute our show across Free Speech TV, their website, and the Dish and cable networks. We also produce and distribute through several websites, including my own and Popular Resistance. And then we have a kind of an informal syndication agreement with many websites, one of them being Truthout, that regularly publishes my work. And that's coming to the point of the suppression here. In the beginning of our half-hour show, I did an introduction to, where I explained to viewers passionately why I was a supporter, a signatory for the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, why I was a proud signatory, along with many other people, of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. And then we did the interview. The interview was slated. The editor I usually work with at Truthout said she was very incredibly moved by the interview, by the piece, by the subject, and it was slated to be published above the fold in digital media terms on the front page of Truthout, where it did land for, I'm told, about 20 or 25 minutes before it was pulled. And it took me several days to get an explanation, and the most forthcoming explanation I got was that the piece was deemed to be an inappropriate endorsement of the organization Stop Patriarchy. Now, what's unique and what's hypocritical about that statement is the fact that a shorter clip, a three-minute clip, in which I introduce my interview with Sansara, in which I explicitly endorse Stop Patriarchy, that video and text was left up on the website, but not the full interview with Sansara. And I should say, you know, that's just one example of how the story is being suppressed from my end. But what I saw as I was preparing to do this interview and as other people on the left found out I was preparing to publish this is that people are saying don't get involved with Stop Patriarchy, don't endorse Stop Patriarchy. People, journalists who are going down there to expose Stop Patriarchy warned me that my credibility, which I'd taken years to build up, was going to be called into question. And the best narrative that I can come up with to explain all of this is that people are either directly linked to the Democratic Party or they're self-censoring based on their idea of the politics of what they think is possible, right? So that's where we are right now, I think, and why Stop Patriarchy is seeing so much resistance both in the streets and in the media for this summer's Abortion Rights Freedom Ride.
Well, Dennis Traynor, perhaps also, as we saw in Ferguson, Missouri, where Carl Dix was specifically targeted by the police chief there for arrest. Carl Dix, no stranger to civil rights issues, also co-founder of the Revolutionary Communist Party, of which Sansara Taylor is also a member.
I'm a supporter.
Thank you for the clarification. Might that have anything to do with it in your estimation?
Absolutely. It directly has to do with it. And I think the person who spoke most eloquently to this was a woman named Diane Derzis, who runs the last abortion clinic in Mississippi, and where Sansara and Stop Patriarchy made a stop on the 2013 abortion rights freedom ride. And as I was doing background for my interview with Sansara, I spoke with her, and she said she got calls and she got emails, and she said, the commies are coming. And she said, you know what, if they're going to stand up and help try to keep my clinic open, I'm happy that they're coming. I don't care. No one's asking me.
Sounds commonsensical to us, Dennis.
I do want to add, there's definitely a campaign of vitriol and slander against the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it's very COINTELPRO type tactics. A lot of it is on Twitter. It's in social media. There's articles and slander, outside agitators, all this sort of thing. I just wanted to fill out the picture just on the censorship. There's a group calling itself Texans for Reproductive Justice, which formed for the sole purpose of wrecking and opposing the abortion rights freedom ride. And they never once mentioned that this round of clinic closures is about to happen. They never once mentioned the emergency confronting Texas and the country. And instead, it's a hatchet job, rumors, tabloid-style rumors, accusations and slanders and misrepresentations of both Stop Patriarchy and of the Revolutionary Communist Party and Bob Avakian, the leader of that party in particular. And then this group, you know, it's interesting. One of the main people behind it then went on and published articles. There was an article that Alternet commissioned from one of their own writers that was covering what the Freedom Ride has done. That article was finished and submitted. It was sat on. It never was published. And instead, Alternet picked up on a hatchet job written by one of the main forces behind this, Texans for Reproductive Justice, so-called, and has been publishing, you know, these attacks, anti-communist attacks, anti-freedom ride attacks, and that's getting widespread play, actually, at this point. Salon.com published an article by the same author. When we asked for a chance to respond, they said there was no way that they would let a group write an article about itself, which is exactly what they did when they let this person publish an attack on us in the name of objectively reporting on slanders and rumors that she herself created. So I think I just wanted to fill out the picture of a pattern of suppression and of misrepresentation. And I definitely think that the idea, look, there's many people on the left, quote unquote left, who have a lot invested in being sort of the franchise managers of the fighters against oppression, but they really have tremendous animus towards the Revolutionary Communist Party and Bob Avakian in particular, because this is a party and this is a leader that's about not just opposing but getting rid of the very root of this, of these horrors in the system, and they're trying to create a situation where that revolutionary force gets isolated and other people are scared away from even standing up against this emergency because you'll be associated with the communists. And on both counts, it's just outrageous and it's unprincipled, and it creates a whole atmosphere where people don't know the crimes being done against women right now and are not able to stand up against it. And it creates an atmosphere where the forces of the state and repression have a lot more water to swim around in and cause, you know, great harm, including the kinds of things that you reported on last week with Carl Dix and others being singled out for arrest and that sort of thing.
Sansara Taylor, it's like a neo-McCarthyism among progressives. And again, Peter Phillips and I are not members of the Revolutionary Communist Party, but we have noticed that on occasion when we have covered certain issues and so forth at Project Censored, we have drawn ire of some of these groups and so forth. Institute for Policy Studies springs to mind, which again isn't to say that these organizations or individuals don't do good work in other areas. Certainly Truth Out does, but it pains us to, if we're going to be honest and we're going to hold ourselves to the same standards against censorship, then we have to speak out about these types of efforts to silence people and to skew or attack people where we do have common cause.
Sansara, we're almost out of time, but you're there. You're one of the organizers of Stop Patriarchy. A number of other activists are there with you, a lot of young women. It seems like an attack on you personally for your maybe ideological orientations versus the issues that have been played out here, and the closing of abortion clinics in Texas in a massive way undermines for any liberal organization, media organization, to not cover that really undermines the issues at hand, and that is closing of abortion clinics. And so
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's I think it's important because obviously this is an attack on us, those of us associated with the Revolutionary Communist Party and those associated with the Abortion Rights Freedom Line. And that should be opposed by everybody just on the principles that Mickey laid out, as well as people should learn. They should defy that slander and find out for themselves and go to revcom.us and learn about the party, or stoppatriarchy.org and learn about the organization. But it has the added effect that you're describing, Peter, of at a watershed moment of one of the greatest moves backwards confronting women's right to abortion, reproductive freedom, that's happened in over 40 years. This is an attempt and an attack to keep people from looking at what's being done to women's lives and standing up to fight against this. And it's very, very damaging because it's not a communist narrative. It's something communists care about, but it's not a communist narrative or something that we've made up, that this is a high-stakes moment for women. This is actually why huge numbers of people who are not communists have united with us in standing up in this abortion rights freedom ride. But many of them have faced exactly what Dennis has said and what he faced, which he's not a communist either. But he was told, if you stand up and you associate with these people, your credibility is going to be dragged through the mud. You're going to be suppressed, and there were threats issued against him and others. And I think this is very, very damaging, and everybody should be concerned and speak out against.
Sansara Taylor, stoppatriarchy.org, Abortion Freedom Ride in Texas, thank you so much for joining us and telling us your story. Dennis Traynor, I'm sorry that we are out of time right now, Acronym TV. But Dennis Traynor, thank you for coming on and sharing your story and taking the courageous stance you did for free speech.
Thanks for having us, guys.
After this musical break, we'll be back with Nafis Ahmed. Stay with us. Back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In the final segment today, we look at civil rights issues and surveillance, and we'll likely get into some other subjects because our guest is Dr. Nafis Mossadegh Ahmed. Nafis is a British author and investigative journalist. He writes for The Guardian newspaper. He is the author of numerous books, including The War on Freedom, Behind the War on Terror, The War on Truth. He is also the filmmaker of The Crisis of Civilization. He has a new fiction work out, Zero Point, and Nafis joins us by phone from, I believe, Washington, D.C., where he has been in New York and D.C. on a current book tour. Nafis, are you with us?
I'm with you. Hi.
Thanks so much for coming on the program. We've been trying to get you on for some time, and we're very delighted we were able to catch you when you were on the East Coast. even though we're here on the left coast and we won't get to see you in person, we're very happy to have you on the Project Censored show. And like to let listeners know also that Nafis wrote the foreword to the Censored 2013 book a couple years ago. So I'd like to thank Nafis for that and all of his work. Tell us, Nafis, what have you been doing in the U.S. and tell us a little bit about your new work.
I'm in the States to launch my new book, which is a novel. It's a political science fiction thriller called Zero Point. It's set in a near future, which attempts to kind of look at a plausible business as usual scenario for where we could be in the next few years. The scenario is that there's another Iraq war, a fourth Iraq war, and the US and the UK have intervened in Iraq. They've reinvaded, they've reoccupied in order to put down an al-Qaeda insurgency, which has destabilized the Maliki regime. And it's essentially it's a war for oil. And it has a dramatic impact, both obviously in the Middle East, in the region, as well as here at home for us in countries like the US and the UK, in terms of, you know, the kind of the way in which political elites try to ramp up the threat to the homeland and kind of crack down on civil liberties and pursue the war on terror at home against dissidents using mass surveillance and kind of essentially criminalizing political dissent. So the story is a work of fiction. I wrote the book as a novel because I wanted to reach out to a wide audience that may not necessarily be engaged in activism, but still needs to kind of understand the message, understand the challenges of our time. So I wanted to do it in a way that was also entertaining, interesting, fun. It would be a great read for anyone just to pick up. That's what I'm here at the moment concentrating on. I'm actually back in New York at the moment. But I'm doing a lot of speaking and meeting lots of great people, learning a lot about the activism that's going on here. So it's been a really good trip.
Nafis, hi, this is Peter Phillips. Good to hear your voice.
Peter, it's great to hear from you.
Yeah, the piece that I'm particularly enjoyed reading and also was very concerning to me was the piece you wrote for Occupy, Pentagon Funds New Data Mining Tools to Track and Kill Activists. And what's specific about this is that not only Department of Defense is funding university research programs, you name Arizona State University, you name Washington University, the professors involved, and they are building these sort of data systems to monitor activist groups worldwide for their potentiality of being terrorists or engaging in political activism. And could you tell us about this? Why is this so concerning?
It is a lot of concern. There's a lot to be concerned about. I mean, I first looked at this whole story about the Pentagon funding universities, social scientists, computer scientists, and so on in order to support Pentagon policy kind of objectives. And this stuff was all being done under a program called the Minerva Research Initiative that was set up in 2008. Obviously, it's not the first time or the only way in which the Pentagon is funding or co-opting social scientists. There have been many other programs, such as the Human Terrain System and others, which I also looked at. And that was in my Guardian piece. But this particular series of pieces I wrote for Occupy.com, which is a four-part series investigating specifically the data mining component of what the Pentagon is now funding. I focused on, as you mentioned, Washington University and Arizona State University, and really went deep into the Arizona State University stuff because their Center for Computer Sciences is basically an NSA-designated institution. It's not clear exactly what that means if you look into the public record and what that kind of certification means, except we know that they've worked with the National Security Agency in the past, have a very strong relationship, so strong that the NSA has decided to certify the work, the research and teaching that goes on at that center. Interestingly also, that center works closely within the same university, another center focusing on homeland security studies, and that department seeks to basically provide training for homeland security officials working both in the public and the private sector. So, you know, that's both in government and in, you know, for corporations working in homeland security. And both those centers apparently have a very close working relationship, according to easily available stuff on their website. So what exactly is going on at these universities? Well, the Pentagon's been funding them to create new data mining tools that will enhance the capacity of the intelligence community to understand and track the nature of social movements, the nature of activism, and what's most disturbing about it is the way in which these groups are to be classified. And the tools that I was able to get access to showed that they basically want to classify groups and individuals on a radicalism threat scale. So in other words, they want to try and identify who's a radical, who's not a radical, who's a counter-radical, and all the rest of it. But what's really kind of what's problematic about it, especially from those of us who are familiar with, you know, the stringent requirements of academic and social science research on these complex issues relating to different societies, social movements, political activism, and all the rest of it, is that you have to be very, very precise in your definitions and your concepts and the way in which you approach these kinds of groups. Well, they're doing the very opposite. You've got these very, very blanket definitions of radicalism. In fact, in all of the literature that I looked at related to the Pentagon's research, I'm not just talking about the Arizona project, I'm talking about the dozens of projects that you can actually go and look at online and double-check, go to university websites, find out more about these projects. Many of them are available in the public domain. All of them have this very blanket definition of radicalism, equating radicalism with violence. Radicalism was seen as basically any kind of support for political violence. There was no acknowledgement of a form of radicalism which did not entail violence, to the point that in one of the projects that I looked at, and they attempted to study specifically nonviolent activists and peaceful activists, the very definition of nonviolent and peaceful activists was so weird and so blurry that it basically entailed any group that in itself may not commit violence, but nevertheless would support radical causes or support causes that involve political violence. So in other words, if you're radical, if you're in any sense kind of like questioning the status quo, there is a danger that you will be considered a radical in the sense of being prone to violence and being prone to be a terrorist or something. And that kind of definition was also clear from the scaling tools that I saw with the more recent projects at ASU, where we had this kind of classification system where independent academics were supposed to come in and kind of scale, you know, hundreds of different organizations across the globe. I mean, the list that I saw was a list of British NGOs in particular. And interestingly, the whole project was supposed to be about targeting Muslim radicalism and looking at it from a theological perspective. But strangely, this list of British NGOs included many organizations which are completely secular, had no religious affiliation, had no affiliation to Islam, but they were politically radical. They were organizations like the Stop the War Coalition, which is an umbrella group of organizations whose members include many respected anti-war groups, you know, the Green Party, most of the unions, civil liberties and civil rights organizations, teachers' unions, you know, all kinds of progressive organizations that really have nothing to do with terrorism, and ironically also nothing to do with Islam or Muslims in particular either. So it seems very clear to me from looking at this that this was very much an effort to kind of feed into the intelligence community's ability to kind of use and analyze social media to automatically scale and track different kinds of groups, different types of dissent, and individuals associated with this.
So, Nafisa, what I'm hearing you say is that American social scientists at various universities, including Arizona and Washington, are using modeling techniques and algorithms in social networks to focus on Muslim organizations in that you're aware of, certainly in England, but also like the Socialist Worker Party and peace activist groups. And once these are in place, and then literally any group could be targeted, and they're coming up with a radicalism scale. so that this is an undermining of any kind of democracy, certainly, in our country, whereby there can be a repression, which could ultimately be drones killing you if it came to that. So I think this is it's quite concerning.
It is concerning. My hunch when I saw some of these different tools, one of the tools developed at ASU was called Looking Glass. And this is a very interesting platform. It was described itself as a visual intelligence platform. And what it would do, it would aggregate material from websites, aggregate material from forums, from all sorts of social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter and so on. And what it would be able to do is it would not only be able to identify individuals and actually kind of rank their degree of threat on this radicalism scale, it would be able to situate them with a social network analysis. It would be able to look at patterns of behavior. What are the other individuals and groups that this particular individual is associated with? And it would be able to follow and track the development and evolution of these individuals and groups in order to analyze these patterns. So immediately when I looked at the scope of these kind of algorithms and different analytical tools, it came to my mind that, we've got these kinds of algorithms which are being used by the CIA to generate kill lists. I mean, how far is this going to go?
Yeah, Nafis Ahmed, in other words, why would they be tracking and building these lists if they didn't intend to do something with them?
Well, exactly. This is exactly the concern that I had. So, when I spoke to the Pentagon people, I went to the official spokesman. I tried to speak to the administrator of the program. I sent them detailed questions in the hopes that I would get some kind of clarification specifying, one, what did they feel this research would be used for? Two, give them an opportunity to really kind of explain how this research would avoid demonizing peaceful activists who are engaged in what we all know to be essential for a vibrant democracy, which is dissent, activism, speaking out, criticizing power. These are the hallmarks of a vibrant democracy. So surely, I would want to know that, I wanted to give the Pentagon the opportunity to clarify that actually, this is about targeting real terrorists. We recognize your concerns. These are the safeguards we've got in place. I was at least expecting to hear, a PR line or something. I didn't even get that. They simply said to me, the various people who I spoke to simply said to me that, in one or another, that basically, look, this is the first response was even worse. The first response when I wrote from The Guardian was basically, look, we are the United States, and the United States is basically going to make sure that it does everything it needs to protect its national security.
Well, Nafis,
so that was kind of like, okay, fine.
Yeah, right. This is another dimension, another layer of COINTELPRO culture. In a lot of ways. And, we saw that during, not only during the 60s and 70s, but certainly all the way through the Bush and now Obama years in the United States. And it also reminds me eerily of Cass Sunstein and his cognitive infiltration type plans. You're familiar you're very familiar with those.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very familiar with Cass Sunstein. And I would absolutely agree that there is a lot of parallels. There's a lot of past precedent that all of this kind of work draws from. Where the difference is that we have a new situation where we have big data. That's the difference.
Yes.
The difference is that in the age of the information era, people willingly volunteer, including myself. You're on these social media sites. You put stuff online. You don't expect that you're going to basically be having this stuff, downloaded and used by corporations and intelligence agencies. But it's out there. And what these agencies have made clear is that anything which is in the public domain, in any form, they think is fair game. When I spoke to Thomas Drake, the former senior executive at the NSA, a well-known whistleblower who actually also inspired Snowden to do what he did. And I asked him, one, I'd like to know whether my hunch that these algorithms actually have a direct application to the CIA's kill lists, and two, what is the driving force of this? He said to me, look, what people don't realize is that the Pentagon, institutionally and ideologically, believes that everything is a militarized battlefield, and that includes social media, that includes the public sphere. So this isn't surprising. And number two, he said to me, in terms of my hunch about the killers, he said, your hunch is absolutely right. These are the same algorithms that he has seen being used to generate the kill list, which go to justify the signature drone strike. And this is very significant because the signature drone strikes are slightly different from the so-called high-value targeted drone strikes, which are supposedly targeting identified Al-Qaeda officials. The signature drone strikes, it's known, are able to target groups of individuals, and we don't necessarily know their names. And, you know, we've had State Department officials, you know, laughing at the CIA's criteria for justifying these kind of strikes, saying that, you know, you go to somewhere like Pakistan and they see three men doing jumping jacks and they're going to say, well, that's a terrorist training camp. And then they'll justify, you know, a signature strike. So that's the danger, is that what we're seeing here is not just an academic exercise, which is how the Pentagon have tried to sell it publicly. And even when I've spoken to some of these academics involved in it, you know, they seem either very naive and credulous about what the Pentagon has told them, that this is just basic research, it's all going to be used for peaceful purposes, or they seem willingly to just, you know, they don't really want to know what the research is being used for. They're just turning a blind eye. And some of them actually have previous Pentagon and CIA connections, which tend to suggest that they know what they're doing, but they're not worried about the moral issues.
Nafees Ahmed. We're speaking with Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, scholar and journalist from Britain. He is in the United States on a current book tour.
We want to smash, crash, mass, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live. Get with the mission.
Our final guest today has been Dr. Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Our show today was on civil rights issues concerning race and gender. We finished up with a piece on surveillance and privacy issues. Thanks to our other guests, Kevin Gostola of Fire Dog Lake. Thanks to Sansara Taylor of Stop Patriarchy and Dennis Trainer of Acronym TV. Also like to thank our producer, Anthony Fest, and Erica Bridgman at the controls. Project Censored Show airs on over 15 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.